welcome to another episode of TP Talks, PwC's Global Transfer Pricing podcast series, where we discuss key transfer pricing developments from around the world. My name is Christina Novak, and I'm a principal in PwC's U.S. National Tax Services Transfer Pricing Practice. In today's episode, we will discuss recent administrative guidance issued by the IRS regarding implicit support and its impact on the pricing of intercompany loan transactions. And spoiler alert, the IRS thinks that implicit support should be considered in pricing intercompany loans. We'll spend some time today discussing the guidance and what we're seeing in the broader global environment regarding intercompany loans and implicit support. But before I get started, let me introduce today's guest speakers. Joining me for today's episode is Bob Ritter. Bob is a transfer pricing principal and is the U.S. Financial Transactions Transfer Pricing Leader. Tanya Kaser. Tanya is a partner with PwC Germany and the Financial Transactions Transfer Pricing Leader for EMEA. And Aaron Oken. Aaron is a principal in PwC's U.S. National Tax Services Transfer Pricing Practice. Welcome, and thank you all for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be joining today's podcast with you.
Yeah, likewise, Christina. Thanks.
Always great to be on. Thanks, Christina.
Perfect. Let's jump in. The implicit support guidance ended up taking the form of a generic legal advice memorandum, or GLAM, as we refer to it. It was issued right at the end of last year on December 29th, 2023. But Bob, can you please kick things off for us? And before we dive into the details, can you please provide a little bit of background on the framework of 482-2, that's our guidance that governs intercompany loan transactions, and also describe what is implicit support and why does the IRS care about this issue?
Yeah, thanks, Christina. So 482-2 is where the financial transactions methods are described for intercompany loans. And there's really three primary approaches that are described there. There's a safe harbor, otherwise you may hear it described as AFR, right? Which basically describes the pricing framework for short-term, medium-term, and long-term loans. There's the size of the borrower rule. And then there's the last one, which is, you know, arm's length terms and conditions, which is what, you know, implicit support would apply to. So implicit support is important, right? So the idea is, should you consider group membership and determine the arm's length rate of interest rate chargeable on loans? And really what that means is, generally speaking, should you basically notch upwards from the standalone rating, assuming that the overall group has a higher credit rating? And this is important because a higher credit rating of the borrower will ultimately result, in all other things equal, a lower interest rate. So the question posed in the GLAM, as you already said in the spoiler alert, right, may the service, you know, consider group membership in determining the arm's length rate of interest chargeable for intergroup loans and making any Section 482 adjustments? That's exactly what, you know, the GLAM, you know, is the question that is posed and answers. And as you said, yes. And I guess this wasn't really a surprise, Christina, right? But maybe you can give us a bit more context and background from a historical perspective.
Yes, I'm happy to do that. In the 2021-2022 IRS Priority Guidance Plan, the IRS had added a regulatory project, and this project was to address this exact issue. The plan was to issue regulations under Section 482 to clarify the effects of group membership in determining arm's length pricing, and this was with respect to financial transactions. And in explaining this regulatory guidance and why it was added to the Priority Guidance Plan, the PGP, Chris Bellow, who is the former IRS Chief Counsel Branch Chief of Branch 6, he explained on panels that, you know, the branch was seeing more and more financial transaction cases where implicit support was coming up, and it would be an important part of that case. And he noted that oftentimes the main point of dispute in the case was whether or not, sort of as a general rule, implicit support should be factored into the pricing analysis for intercompany financial transactions. And so the reason for adding this guidance to the IRS PGP in the first place was to provide clarity on the issue to both taxpayers and tax practitioners. So we knew guidance on this issue was coming, and we knew it was coming in the form of regulations. But then towards the end of 2023, the IRS started to signal on panels that they would be issuing sub-regulatory guidance on this issue. before issuing regulations on this topic. And so, as we had already noted, the guidance was ultimately issued as a GLAM, which meant, and this is stated in the first paragraph of the guidance, that the advice, it's not precedential, it's not binding. And this guidance appears to be merely formalizing the IRS's position on this issue. The implicit support regulatory project also remains on the IRS PGP. So this project was listed in the second quarter update to the 2023-2024 IRS PGP. So I think we can expect to see regulations in the future on this particular issue. But regarding the outcome of the guidance, so this guidance, it aligns with the OECD guidance on financial transactions that was issued back in 2020, which Treasury through Working Party 6 had a role in drafting. And so I don't think the outcome of the guidance, which is that implicit support should be considered when pricing intercompany loans, I don't think that's surprising at all. But Bob, can you walk our listeners through the specifics of the guidance?
Yeah, I think the one thing I want to make sure we note too is that it really focuses solely on pricing. It assumes that, you know, it's the debt is bona fide debt, and it also has nothing to do with the quantum of the debt. So how much could a borrower take on? But if we just jump into the example, the example they give is a foreign parented company that has, you know, 100% owned U.S. subsidiary. And on a standalone basis, the sub goes out, gets a third party credit rating from an independent agency, and on a standalone basis would be rated single B. And the examples it gives in the credit ratings are A, triple B, double B, and single B. And on a standalone basis, it would have an arm's length rate of 10%. However, the foreign parent has a overall group rating of A. And so under the example in the GLAM, including implicit support and considering the impact, it brings the U.S. subsidiary rating up from single B to triple B. So basically two notches up in their example. So still one notch below the parent, but two notches up from the standalone rating, which would the impact on the rate goes from 10% to 8%. So essentially 2% savings differential.
Thanks, Bob. Aaron, bringing you into the discussion, what are some issues or considerations that we should be thinking about?
Sure. Thanks, Christina. So I think, you know, like as was mentioned, right, the GLAM is non-binding. And so, I mean, that's the first thing to kind of recognize is that this memorandum is not really sort of any sort of independent, you know, legal authority that's adding, adding to the sort of existing body of tax law beyond just serving the purpose of documenting and memorializing what the IRS's position is on this issue. And the way that the IRS sort of has developed their position is, you know, by reference to existing law, you know, unsurprising given that this is not, you know, this itself is not a new regulation or sort of a precedential piece of guidance. And so the IRS is focused on in particular is primarily on the realistic alternatives piece of the Section 482 regulations, which in the Section 482-1 regulations, the regs there provide that the IRS can consider, you know, alternatives realistically available to a taxpayer, when evaluating the pricing of a particular transaction, right? And so this is a generally applicable principle. It's not something that's specific to intercompany loans. The way the IRS has applied it in this context is that if we go back to the example, right, you have a subsidiary that has a parent of the group that has a higher credit rating when you take into account implicit support. And, you know, they could pay 10% on a standalone credit rating basis, or they could pay 8% interest on a credit rating basis that takes account of implicit support. If they, you know, the IRS assumes that they could have gone out and borrowed from a third party, then when you take into account the options realistically available to the borrower would not pay a 10% rate if they could, you know, otherwise pay an 8% rate. That's sort of the basic theory of the IRS's position here. Now, in that respect, it's not really so surprising. Kind of makes sense that they would point to the realistic alternatives principle. But, you know, one thing that needs to be considered is that the realistic alternatives principle, you know, does look at the particular facts and circumstances of the transaction, right? in order for an alternative to be realistically, you know, available, it has to be realistically available. So that would mean that, you know, if a subsidiary could not actually go out onto the open market and borrow, you know, for whatever reason, right, that would put pressure on the applicability of the realistic alternatives principle to actually require a modification to the interest rate in a particular set of circumstances. So I think, you know, the approach that the IRS is taking here isn't particularly surprising, but it also needs to be understood that it's not a one-size-fits-all position here and that the facts and circumstances are still really, really important. You know, the second thing that kind of stands out with the IRS's argument here is that they're taking a position that says that we can assume away group membership for some aspects of the analysis, but not others, right? So they point out in the memo that some have asked this question, well, you know, if the parent is loaning to a subsidiary, then the parent's not going to be able to be in a position to benefit from this implicit support that that a third-party borrower would be able to benefit from. And so the IRS attempts to answer that by saying, they give a couple of different answers, but sort of the one that I wanted to focus on is this idea that, like, you know, for 482 purposes, we're going to assume that they are not related parties, right? Which is fine. I think that's not a controversial position. But what's interesting then is that they do assume and they take into the take into consideration that they actually are related parties when it comes to the credit rating analysis. That's on the realistic alternatives point. I mean, they do add some clarification at the end that that is, I think, somewhat helpful, right? That implicit support is not a compensable benefit, you know, under 482-9, that really it's just sort of a passive association type of benefit. So they're, you know, implicit support's not something that you'd have to take into account as a separately compensable benefit, you know, in the framework that the IRS has sort of set out here. You know, it is interesting that there are a couple of footnotes in the memo that reference the OECD guidelines. And it's interesting because, you know, from a U.S. perspective, the OECD transfer pricing guidelines are not binding. They're not law in the U.S. And the IRS has taken the position, has been very explicit on this in a GLAM issued in 2007, that, you know, from an IRS enforcement perspective, it needs to be, you know, enforcement needs to be based on 482 without any sort of reference to the OECD transfer pricing guidelines. And so the idea that they've dropped this in here is interesting. Could just be an observation that their position is consistent with the OECD guidelines. It could also be potentially a hint as to the direction that any sort of future reg package might go.
And just for our listeners, I know sometimes we throw out a lot of regulatory numbers out there, but 482-9, which is our services regulations, right? So generally that's covering services.
Thanks, Bob. That's helpful for that explanation. Thank you both. Looking at this from a broader context, Bob, where are we at and how does this guidance fit into the broader scheme?
Yeah, thanks, Christina. I think we've been finding that, I mean, countries around the world have been finding ways to, you know, reduce or have ways to impact, you know, intercompany financing, you know, is a way of base eroding subsidiaries, right? So I think this sort of goes in line with what we've been seeing. And there's a long history of this. And I think it just depends on sort of, I think, timing and just, you know, where it's at, which I know Tanya will probably get into a bit, give us a bit more of the broader EMEA view. But I think what I've been seeing is it really is being attacked in so many different ways, right? There's certain aspects that try and attack the quantum of the debt, right? Is you know, the entire amount debt, or is a portion of that equity, or is it an all or nothing type of test? There's other ways just around interest limitations, right? In the US, we've got section 163J, and this isn't really about saying it's good or bad debt. It's just a matter of, hey, how much debt, you know, are we going to allow you to deduct in any one year, and are we going to allow you to carry it forward? I think we see variations of this, you know, globally, whether it's some sort of portion of EBITDA or some other limitation. And then just, you know, overall in the rate itself, right, which is exactly what the implicit support issue is trying to attack. And I think more broadly, right, I think you see a lot more other ways that, you know, countries are attacking this, such as the business purpose and the substance is sort of why debt, you know, why did you even need to issue the debt? And, you know, you see challenges, I think, across the world on this and sort of just challenging the overall purpose of the debt. If we just kind of come back maybe to the U.S. and even look about, well, where have we seen successes, or where have we seen other, you know, issues around trying to attack this? We've, you know, I think in the early 2010s, we go back and, you know, there was a myriad of sort of debt versus equity cases, right? Scottish Power is a pretty famous one. And so you had, you know, trying to just attack whether or not the debt is debt or if it's equity, right? And that seemed to sort of have some issues. And then in 2016, Section 385 regulations were released, right? Which, had a lot of rules that were out there, you know, around financing issues, right, for companies. And, you know, back then some of the documentation rules and things that were in there were also then, you know, later reduced. And then you kind of go forward to 2018 and the OECD, you know, released this, you know, sort of financial transactions guidance, which was draft and then finalized in 2020, which later became, you know, part of the OECD Chapter 10 guidelines. And obviously that deals with implicit support. But that, as Aaron already noted, right, is not really U.S. law. It's, you know, the U.S. can refer to it, but we, you know, definitely something that we're not referring to. And so that has to do with a lot of foreign borrowers, right? So I think what you see there, and, you know, a lot of countries using that to say, hey, if it's a U.S. parented company that's lending out, there is this expectation in many countries of sort of using implicit support and guidance. And so sort of a restriction and, you know, on the rating and the rate itself. And so I think if we look at what the GLAM is doing, you know, in 2023, it's the inverse of that, right? So now we're looking at, you know, sort of foreign parented companies that are lending into the U.S. And I think the, you know, U.S. sort of giving a bit of a view that's similar in line with what the OECD is doing, right, that they can then point to.
Thanks, Bob. Shifting a bit more to the global perspective, Tanya, what are you seeing from an EU perspective or from just simply a non-U.S. lens?
Yeah, thanks, Christina. So in EMEA, what we are seeing is that, well, firstly, we've got a lot of smaller countries in EMEA, and frankly, in a lot of those countries, they don't have the specific guidance that perhaps the US or Germany or some other bigger markets may be having on this very specific topic. So what that means is that oftentimes the OECD guidelines in Chapter 10 are just super important when it comes to analyzing and documenting the arm's length nature of intercompany loans. So I wouldn't underestimate the necessity of really understanding the OECD guidelines very closely. Now, what may seem like a good news here, well, also adds some complexity, because once you had to have a look at a closer look at the OECD guidelines, you will realize that it still leaves a lot of room for interpretation, and a lot of different scenarios may potentially find some support in the OECD. Now, because I'm coming from Germany, and because this has been a topic that I think Germany has been a little bit famous for in recent years, so we've had a draft legislation, administrative guidance, and court rulings on the question of rating analysis for intercompany loans. So I might just add some perspectives on how other countries are dealing with this topic. So in Germany, to perhaps some of our listeners' surprises, the perspective has been more towards favoring a group rating approach. And there are two main arguments on why this was seen as the best approach for German purposes. Now, the first argument was, from the tax audit's perspective, is that both the implicit support analysis, but also a standalone analysis, can be relatively complex in their practical application. And they are really just analysis that you would need to do for TP purposes. So in a way, not having to rely on those analysis was seen as almost a simplification for taxpayers, and simply to rely on the group rating, which is oftentimes available. And the second argument was that, well, there is this circular kind of analysis often necessary, because if you want to do the rating analysis, regardless on whether how you factor in implicit support or not, you need financial data, you need balance sheet information, which in turn can be impacted by your transfer pricing arrangement. So at the end of the day, this is why there was a great push towards simply not doing any of these analysis at all, but relying on the group rating. Now, the highest fiscal court in Germany has ruled that this is not convincing, this is not seen to be in line with arm's length transactions, arm's length behavior, and that indeed the starting point, if anything, should be the standalone rating, considering to the extent necessary the fact that a borrower is part of a group, which is really that implicit support argument. Now, so this is where we stand in Germany at the moment. So I think there is probably also in Germany, despite this long debate over the recent years, more or less kind of a consensus that implicit support is the way to go. But at the end of the day, with all the complexities that are coming with it. Now, two other similarities that I sense are not different in Europe or in Germany compared to what I've just heard from your discussions around the US is that there are different rules and regulations that taxpayers have to deal with. So the GLAM or some administrative guidance, it could be court rulings, it could be regulations that need to be considered. And then secondly, that this also seems to be focused very heavily on the pricing of inbound loans, where there seems to be not that much guidance on how you would deal with outbound loans and whether the similar rules would apply also on in an outbound context. So this is, again, I think, a quite interesting topic. Now, in Germany, just a last sentence here, in an outbound context, there is a similar arguments also being made, but there oftentimes we're seeing the challenges around whether lending into certain countries would inherently come with greater risks than to stay where perhaps in the European Union or in the US, and just by virtue of lending into different markets, you would need to have a certain risk premium on top of that.
Thank you for that, Tanya. So with controversy or audits in mind, what are some approaches that should be considered? Aaron?
Sure. So I think the first thing is, like I said before, the facts and circumstances matter. And so I think recognizing that this guidance is out there and that, you know, the memo is basically directed, it's internal guidance for the IRS for their, you know, exam function, right? Even though it's not sort of new law, I think it's incumbent on taxpayers to really give a lot of consideration to what's in there. Also give consideration to what's in the OECD guidelines as well, notwithstanding, you know, that the OECD guidelines aren't US law. I know that in prior audits that I've been involved in, you know, there have been sort of references made to it. You know, there's definitely a flavor, at least, of OECD guidance in some of the arguments that I've seen made by the IRS. I do think it's important to kind of take into account the full picture, you know, whether they state it in terms of the OECD or not. I mean, you know, definitely it's something that can, you know, we should expect as sort of inspiration for positions. So think about the facts and circumstances. Think about, you know, is it, you know, what's the sort of the importance of the borrower to the group? Like, is it really that it would rise to the level where if you were to look at credit rating agency guidance that it actually would, you know, bring about implicit support? Think also about the, you know, sort of the particular circumstances and whether a borrower would actually, you know, realistically be able to borrow from a third party. And that could be sort of based on the unique circumstances of the borrower. It could also be based on circumstances of the group. From a pricing perspective, I think, you know, it makes sense to consider sensitivities around different approaches, right? So potentially run multiple analyses, right? With implicit support, without implicit support. You know, as Bob mentioned earlier, there is this US safe harbor based on the AFR, right, with an upper bound of 130% of the relevant AFR. And so, you know, taxpayers may want to consider, okay, like if I run a, you know, a interest rate benchmarking analysis and, you know, with implicit support or without implicit support, it gets to a particular result that, you know, depending on how rates are, like may or may not be far enough from the AFR safe harbor, you know, upper bound. You know, taxpayers may consider whether it's worth the risk, the audit risk, and opt for an AFR safe harbor rate if it's not too far off. But yeah, as we think about how best to defend exams, I think there will be a lot of value associated with having a robust economic analysis that demonstrates that that the result that's selected is supportable. You know, especially if it's supportable based on a standalone credit rating as well as one with implicit support. The other thing just to sort of note also is, you know, companies should not be in a mindset where the guidance and approach set forth in the GLAM is applicable only to, you know, parent subsidiary loans. The GLAM does, you know, tie in at the end that this theory applies also with respect to loans between brother sister corporations, and we also know from at least, you know, from a docketed case that the IRS has applied this line of thinking also with respect to you know, adjusting guarantee fees that are paid by a U.S. Subsidiary to its foreign parents. So it's not just a parent sub loan relationship. This is something that should be considered across, you know, all types of intercompany financing transactions.
Aaron, there's one point I'd be particularly interested in. Now, the audit risk and your recommendations around the economic analysis that you just laid out, would that be any different whether you have loans entered into the past where interest rate has already been set, or whether this is only something applicable on new loans where you're still in the lucky position where you can set an interest rate based on those economic analysis?
That's a great question. I think, you know, given that this is that the GLAM represents the IRS's view of how the regulations that have been in place for decades at this point should be applied, I do think, and we've seen this position in audit in prior years too. So I don't think that, you know, taxpayers should view this as just prospective guidance. You know, so obviously when we think about things like transfer pricing documentation and making sure that that's robust, you know, flexibility may be limited for years that have already been completed. But that said, in the context of an examination, I think, you know, being able to come forth with corroborative economic analyses can still be a powerful tool for trying to get to a resolution with the IRS in the context of an exam.
Thanks.
Well, before we sign off today, I want to get everyone's takeaway. Bob, let's start with you, Aaron, and then we'll wrap up with Tanya.
Yeah, thanks, Christina. So I think consider the fact you'll need to anticipate, you know, the sort of the questions and challenges that may come up if you purely are looking at a standalone rating. I know, as Aaron had mentioned, kind of is going through, right, the realistic alternatives principle, you know, and those sorts of things should be something that you should have in your write-ups and consider. And I think the days of, hey, here's a standalone rating without any other sort of considerations would be subject potentially to challenge. So, you know, I think there's various ways to come up with an estimation of a credit rating. And you know, there's this sort of top-down approach, which is sort of using the overall group rating and sort of notching down. Or as this, you know, this issue is really kind of coming up with, it's the bottoms-up approach. And so I think, you know, using all of those sort of considerations should be something that, you know, any prudent company that's looking to put an intercompany debt should definitely consider on a go-forward basis.
From my perspective, you know, I'd say that this is not a new issue. The IRS has had initiated many audits on this issue in the past and, you know, continue to do so. We know, like I mentioned, that there's a docketed case that deals with these issues. So I think, you know, we can expect that this is something that is still going to continue to be an area of focus. And that's something that is fairly clearly signaled by the release of this memo.
Yeah, from my perspective, my takeaway would be that the complexity that follows from this implicit support approach, which we alluded to in today's discussion and with the analysis of the facts and circumstances, I think companies these days are really well advised to think about how those facts and circumstances apply to them specifically and to develop an internal policy on how they apply this in their specific scenarios and to document that accordingly also for TP documentation purposes and have that consistently apply all inbound and outbound loans. And I think once you've done that, you should also be in a very good position if and when the tax auditors come knocking and asking questions.
Thank you for those final thoughts and observations. This is an important topic that we wanted to highlight for our listeners. And much like all of transfer pricing, implicit support, it's a facts and circumstances analysis. And therefore, facts like how strategic your borrower is to the group will need to be considered in analyzing the impact of implicit support in both your intercompany financing transactions and your guarantee fee transactions. So thank you, Tanya, Bob, and Aaron, for joining me today and for your insights into this topic. I also want to thank our listeners for tuning in. We'll be back next month with our next episode of TP Talks. Until then, have a great day.
This podcast is brought to you by PwC, all rights reserved. PwC refers to the U.S. member firm or one of its subsidiaries or affiliates and may sometimes refer to the PwC network. Each member firm is a separate legal entity. Please see www.pwc.com/structure for further details. This podcast is for general information purposes only and should not be used as a substitute for consultation with professional advisors.